Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Good morning and welcome to Visegrad Insight podcast. My name is Adam Jasse and I will be your host for today's episode devoted to the euro adoption in Central and Eastern Europe. It is my great pleasure to introduce our guest today, Sol Darvas, a renowned economist working at Bruegel, which is a leading European economic policy think tank. Sol, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sol joined Bruegel as a visiting fellow in 2008 and became senior fellow in 2013. He's also a senior research fellow at the Corvinus University of Budapest. One of his most notable papers was an analysis debunking Thomas Piketty's argument that economic benefits of EU funds and EU membership for new countries from the East was largely offset by the outflow of private sector profits. But today, we're not going to discuss that. We're going to discuss another aspect of economic development in Central and Eastern Europe, namely euro adoption. The topic may not be front page news these days, but occasionally the discussion about it comes back. And in recent weeks, we had a speech by the Czech president who urged his country to adopt the euro, and also the change of government in Poland prompted some analysts to speculate that the new team, pro-European, may relaunch euro preparations. In a sense, this is understandable, this focus on the euro, because it's a paradox. The biggest four economies in the region, Poland, Romania, Czechia, and Hungary, have lagged behind some of the smaller economies, such as the Baltic states, Slovakia, and now Croatia, when it comes to adopting the single currency. It seems that the main reason for that is mostly politics. There are no sufficient political majorities in parliaments of these countries in favor of dropping the national currency, even though legally they're obliged to do that. But the issue, again, I want to discuss today is not politics, but the economic aspects of euro adoption in Central and Eastern Europe. And with that, I'm going to turn to Zsolt and say, the main question that springs to mind is, to what extent this should be a policy priority for the four countries I just mentioned? Does it really matter whether they adopt the euro? And if so, what is the balance of advantages and risks?
In the medium and long term, euro membership would bring benefits to the current euro outs, but I wouldn't say that this is a top priority at the moment. Now, let me elaborate both of my points somewhat. So, first of all, we had a study in which we analyzed the macroeconomic developments of Central European EU members, which are inside the euro and outside the euro, and also compared these countries to Southern European countries, which joined the euro either in 1999 or in Greece in 2001, and which countries had suffered major unsustainable developments and then a very deep crisis after the global financial crisis of the late 2000s and the euro crisis of the early 2010s. And I mean, our findings showed that, first of all, why some Central European countries had similar problems to Southern European countries before the global financial crisis, so before 2008. These countries were able to adjust inside the, with their fixed currencies or inside the Eurozone. I mean, most notably, we can mention the three Baltic countries, which had even more extreme credit growth, more extreme house price increases than, let's say, what happened in Spain. Now, these countries faced a tough adjustment, but ultimately they were able to do the adjustment, keeping their fixed exchange rates. Since then, all three Baltic countries became members of the euro area. And since they are just doing fine. They have very good growth and high employment. So their economic performance was really remarkable. Another example is the Slovak Republic, which joined the euro in 2009. But we have to recall that the exchange rate at which the former Slovak koruna was fixed to the euro was decided in the summer of 2008, just 3 months before Lehman Brothers collapsed. And in summer 2008, all Central European floating currencies, including the Polish zloty, the Czech koruna, the Slovak koruna, and the Hungarian forint, and the Romanian lei, They were very, very strong, perhaps the strongest nominal value ever since the euro was introduced. And that very strong exchange rate was fixed for Slovakia because, you know, the rate was fixed in July 2008. Then a few months later, the Lehman Brothers collapsed. The currencies of Poland, Czech Republic and Hungary depreciated by 20-30%. But the Slovak currency did not depreciate because it was already fixed to the euro. So Slovakia entered the euro at a very strong, a very high exchange rate. And since then, Slovakia is doing fine without having an independent monetary policy, without having the exchange rate as a tool to adjust to macroeconomic shocks, which is a major argument many economists use in favor of having a floating exchange rate. Despite lacking all of these, Slovakia is just doing fine. I can also mention Bulgaria, for example, which since its stabilization in the late 1990s has a fixed exchange rate, the most strongest form, which is a so-called currency board regime, is applied in Bulgaria since the late 1990s. I mean, initially compared to the German mark and since the euro was introduced relative to the euro, meaning there is no domestic monetary policy at all, no exchange rate fluctuation at all. And if you look at, let's say, Bulgaria's export performance, it was as good as that of Poland or Hungary. So despite a completely fixed exchange rate in a small open economy, their economic performance was really remarkable and similar and in some aspects even better than that of the floating currency countries like Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic. So these examples clearly show that it is possible to live inside the euro area for Central European countries, which have converging economies and have at the same time having good macroeconomic performances. We can also look at what happened during the COVID crisis and the aftermath of the high inflation period with the energy shock following Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, Hungary, my own country, with its floating exchange rate, had the highest inflation rate across the whole European Union. I mean, the peak inflation rate was more than 25% in annual terms. So absolutely shocking. I mean, nobody would have predicted a year or two before that the inflation rate would increase to such a high degree, which forced the Central Bank of Hungary to raise interest rates. And basically the main interest rate used for monetary policy making had to increase to 18%. Now, at the same time, the European Central Bank also raised interest rates. It raised interest rates, the deposit rate, to 4%. Now, again, we can see the difference between 18 and 4. So Eurozone countries were able to operate with a 4% interest rate, obviously benefiting businesses and households who would like to borrow. But in Hungary, this very high inflation necessitated a much higher interest rate. Again, disadvantaging everyone who would like to make a new borrowing. And also lots of earlier borrowers had to pay a much higher interest rate. So again, during such, I would say, crisis-like episodes, being inside the euro, I think, was very beneficial for those countries that are in. And, you know, some countries that are out, including Hungary, in fact, face major disadvantages of not having the euro, but instead had to fight, for example, high inflation with only domestic policies.
Right. But at the beginning, you said that this was not an urgent issue. But what you just said indicates that, in fact, they would be better off if they were in the eurozone.
So in the medium and long term, I'm convinced that these countries would be better off. Now, joining euro takes time. So, I mean, first of all, both former economic criteria must be met, which includes and which I think the most difficult at the current stage would be the inflation criterion, which requires that the inflation rate of the applicant country cannot be higher than the average of the three countries with the lowest inflation rate plus 1.5 percentage points. Now, meeting these criteria under such current situations when we still, you know, have volatile energy prices could be very, very difficult. And I'm afraid this will also make Bulgaria's challenge to join the euro much, much more difficult. But also, you know, for Hungary and some other countries outside the region, you know, reaching a relatively low level of inflation would be very difficult. Moreover, this criterion is formulated in a very strange way, because the three countries with the lowest inflation rate are considered from the whole European Union. For example, it happens sometimes, you know, I mean, I don't know whether the listeners can recall that Lithuania applied for euro membership in 2006. And that time, the three countries with the lowest inflation included Poland and Sweden. Plus, I think, I don't know which was the third country was from the Eurozone, but I remember that two countries, Poland and Sweden, were not from the Eurozone, but others from the EU. And at that time, Poland witnessed a relatively significant appreciation in the Polish zloty exchange rate relative to the euro. And we know that appreciation can decrease prices or decrease inflation. So probably that explained why Poland has an unusually low inflation rate. And Lithuania missed this criterion by 0.1%. And at that time, the European Council concluded that Lithuania cannot join. So meeting the inflation criterion currently would be very challenging, and that would require both major monetary contraction and also very significant fiscal contraction. And I'm afraid that, I mean, these short-term costs could be very, very significant. So I think for the current euro outs, it would be better to wait a few more years until the general inflation trend everywhere will moderate. And at that stage, it would be, I think, much less painful to meet the inflation criterion.
Right. So in a sense, what you're saying is it's the timing is important, and you need some basic macroeconomic stability, or let's say the basic macroeconomic stability across the euro area is sort of making joining the single currency an easier process.
Yes, both in the euro area and also in the applicant countries, I would like to add. So without that, it would be very, very difficult. And you know, the another tricky criterion is there is also a criterion on the interest rate, which also requires that the interest rate of the applicant country cannot be more than 2 percentage points higher than the interest rate of the three countries with the lowest inflation. And again, for some countries, this might also prove to be challenging. And, you know, that the interest rates entirely depend on market expectations. So if the applicant country can convince markets that the euro prospect is a real possibility, then of course, I mean, interest rates will fall because markets know that, you know, the country will enter the eurozone in a few years. And at that point in time, its interest rates will likely fall significantly. So interest rates will start to fall right now. But if market is skeptical whether the country can make it, then, you know, the country can't really do anything about it to lower the long-term interest rate. Now, obviously, the country can reduce its public debt and budget deficit, but that's not an easy task. And reducing the public debt takes many, many years.
Right. But there is another issue, because you mentioned the nominal criteria, and of course they're formal and they need to be approved, and you know everybody is going to watch it, so it's not so easy to skirt the issue. But you know, when I remember some of the discussions about Eurozone membership related to the southern countries, but also some Central and Eastern European countries, many economists were skeptical about membership of some of these countries, saying what really matters is real convergence. So basically the similar level of economic development, similar level of overall costs in the economy, and so on and so forth. How do you see that real convergence? Because obviously over time, it should be increasing as these countries tend to have higher growth rates and an increasing per capita income, relative to their Eurozone peers. So what I'm trying to say is that over time, this real convergence may actually bring them closer to a level where joining the Eurozone is not going to be such an issue.
So let me explain from what perspective real convergence could be important and why, firstly, and secondly, why I think that looking forward, this is not relevant anymore. Now, the first question, why real convergence could be important, this is largely motivated by what happened in Southern European countries in the early 2000s. Because when those countries joined, then their nominal interest rate suddenly fell, but inflation remained high. So the so-called real interest rate, the nominal interest rate minus inflation, became negative. That fueled everyone, to households and businesses alike, to borrow, households to borrow and buy houses, businesses to borrow and do investments and whatever they wanted to do. But unfortunately, that process proved to be unsustainable. They resulted in very large current account deficits, and ultimately there was a painful adjustment period. Now, how does it relate to real convergence? It's related to a very simple mechanism, namely that countries at a lower level of economic development tend to have lower prices. So if someone goes to Bulgaria now, then, you know, haircut is cheaper than a haircut in Luxembourg, which is a much richer country. But it also means that as lower income countries gradually converge to higher income countries, not just their economic performance improves, but also the price level also improves. So the continuing the example, the price of a Bulgarian haircut will grow faster and will approach, you know, I mean, in the long run, you know, the, let's say, the average price level elsewhere in the Eurozone. So it means that in converging countries, it can be expected that inflation will be higher than the rest of the Eurozone. So if a country joins the Eurozone at a low level of development, it continues to converge in real terms, then it also implies that inflation will likely be higher than the rest of the Eurozone. And if the same happens, what happened in Southern Europe, then this would mean that, you know, the real interest rates will be negative again, because from that point, the nominal interest rate will be determined by the European Central Bank, which focuses on the average of the euro area, you know, determined by Germany, France, and other Western European countries. So the nominal interest rates will be low, inflation will be high, and that might encourage unsustainable housing and credit developments. So this is, I think, is a clear rationale. But I said that my second point in answering your question will be explaining why I don't think that this matters looking forward. Now, first of all, is what happened in those Central European countries that already joined, you know, the Baltics and Slovakia most notably. Again, in these countries continued their economic convergence and they did not develop unsustainable credit booms. So why this is the case? You know, one reason is that another lesson from the crisis in Southern Europe in the early 2010s was that, you know, banking regulation must be much more careful. Also supervision must be much more careful. So now whenever you know, a bank lends to a individual to buy a house, you know, they look at, you know, much more closely how creditworthy that individual is. The so-called loan to value ratio is reduced everywhere, meaning that, you know, you can't borrow the full amount of the house, but, you know, you have to have, you know, at least one third or one half of the house value and get a loan only for the remaining part. They also look at what is the regular income of the prospective borrower, and they don't allow the regular, the borrower to pay larger than a certain amount of its monthly income. So let's say it can't pay than one quarter of its income in servicing the debt. They also look at, you know, how interest rates could change in the future and make some scenarios that look, if interest rates go up, how much rental payment could grow up. So now the financial regulation and credit policies became, I would say, became tighter, but I would say became much more reasonable, because indeed now such people get credit who are more credit worthy. So again, the risk coming from this credit boom channel, I think, is also lower because not just banks learn that, but also authorities learn the same lesson. And also authorities have lots of new tools, which are frequently called macroprudential instruments. So whenever they notice that, you know, in a country, certain financial developments, like, for example, too fast growth of credit is ongoing, then they have specific tools to slow that down, to avoid the risk of such housing bubbles and credit bubbles emerging, what characterized Southern European countries in the 2000s. So this also means that if I think that, you know, a somewhat higher inflation in these, let's say, newer EU members within the Eurozone would be acceptable, and it might not create such problems than what problems we saw in Spain and elsewhere in the 2000s.
This is very interesting, because also I presume, you know, one of the lessons from the crisis, from the Eurozone crisis, was that prior to that crisis, basically there was no longer any differentiation between country risk in the Eurozone. So in other words, the interest paid by governments, by individual governments on their euro-denominated debt, basically there was no difference between German debt and Greek debt. And of course, we see now, which was a mistake, because obviously the exposure or the credit risk was different. It's just that the markets were over-enthusiastic about this. And one of the lessons of the crisis is that the markets need to watch and monitor macroeconomic performance, even within the Eurozone, and attach different ways, so to speak, to different countries. And we see today that governments are being disciplined by the markets within the Eurozone, depending on the quality of their fiscal position and overall macroeconomic policy. So in other words, you know, there is a differentiation between what the German government pays for its debt and what the Greek government pays for its debt, or for Spain or for others. So is that another element where there will be some checks on potentially irresponsible macroeconomic policy within the Eurozone?
A very good point, and I just can very much agree with that. Indeed, before 2007, 2008, even the 10-year government borrowing costs were almost same. There were very, very minuscule differences. And that encouraged also countries like Greece to believe that, you know, this will last forever. The government can do whatever it would like to. It can spend as much as they want to. Even though we had the fiscal rules, you know, the Stability and Growth Pact, which required public debt to remain below 60% of GDP. You know, some countries like, you know, Greece and Italy had much higher of that, even when they entered. And they were not, even during the good years in the early 2000s, they were very small declines in these high debt ratios, because markets simply financed everything. Now, the global financial crisis and after the euro crisis was a wake-up call to everyone. And in fact, at that time, there was, you know, too much market pressure, if I can say it that way. I mean,
a pendulum went the other way.
yes. But then, you know, came Mario Draghi with, you know, this whatever it takes, we will do within our mandate to preserve the euro. And also since then, the European Central Bank, even more recently, during the high inflation period of the past 2 years, the European Central Bank, for example, invented a new instrument, which they call transmission protection instrument. which in principle could be used in a case when a country has strong fundamentals, but the market somehow speculates against that country, and the interest rate increases to a very high level, which is not supported by fundamentals. In such a case, the ECB can intervene even without any formal bailout programs. So I think, I mean, lots of discussion about this instrument, whether it would ever work or not, and how it would work if so, because this was so far just an announcement, but there was no need to use it since then. But I think such instruments are ultimately useful because indeed, I mean, there could be a so-called self-fulfilling speculation, which can even push a fully solvent country to the brink of default. But if markets know that, you know, if its country ultimately has a good fundamentals, then it might not work to speculate against it. So I think this will help.
And if there is a bazooka hanging there in the ECB building.
Indeed. So this will, I think, help to keep the interest rate differentials across Eurozone countries, I mean, under some control. But yes, we do see that, for example, Italy pays about 2 percentage points more than Germany on its long-term debt, which I, as an economist, I would say it's roughly, you know, the right magnitude. And it keeps a pressure on the Italian government that, yes, you know, the country has more than 140% of GDP public debt ratio, you know, more than two times the 60% required by the Maastricht Treaty. Unfortunately, this is the reality that if a country has such a high ratio, it has to pay a higher cost and has to work on reducing it. So I very much welcome indeed that the market started to function. And I also have that indeed this ECB instrument will keep markets under control, but still market will signal whenever a country is doing unsustainable policies.
Right. So paradoxically, you could argue that actually it should be much easier now for the euro outs to join the euro, because first there are the experience and the mistakes. You can learn from the mistakes of the previous euro adoption episodes. There are mechanisms in place and real convergence is progressing. So at some stage, it should basically be just replacing the picture on the banknote.
I agree, but I also think that ultimately this is a political decision. So economists can explain whatever they want to politicians, but it will be very much the politicians' perceptions and beliefs whether they want to join or not. So yes, as time passes, and especially if the current still relatively high inflation episode will moderate, let's say in the next 2 or 3 years, at that point, it might be indeed, I think there could be a chance for the current house to join, but I'm afraid it's an entirely political decision whether to do that.
Right. Is there anything? Because this is an argument which very often is raised, that there are no tangible, clear-cut benefits of quick euro adoption, and at the same time that there is no visible, let's say, punishment for not being in the eurozone or disadvantage of not being in the eurozone, because these countries continue to grow pretty well overall. So, but are they reaching a point where the absence of the euro is going to affect their ability to grow or attract investment? So in other words, are there going to be incentives for the politicians to actually speed up euro adoption?
I'm afraid the economic incentives are limited. So why I argue that all Central European countries would do better inside the eurozone in the medium and long term, probably the difference is not that big. So growth might be a little bit faster. Certainly, I mean, companies would benefit from not having a volatile exchange rate, which are, you know, trading with other eurozone members. ordinary people would benefit that, you know, when they travel, they don't have to exchange their domestic currency to euro and back, facing exchange rate risk and various kind of costs. So lots of things would be simpler, lower risk would come. But, you know, a politician whose main goal is re-election at the next election, which is typically 1, 2, 3 or at most 4 years everywhere in Europe. So they are looking at more what to do to achieve that. And, you know, unless there is a very strong consensus among the population that, yes, we must introduce the euro, then, you know, the incentives for somewhat limited benefits in the medium term, but it still might, you know, require efforts both on the fiscal side, especially on the inflation side, then these vote maximizing politicians might just delay that.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That was, I'm afraid, what I suspected as well. But just imagine for a moment that you have a crystal ball and you're looking into it. So what would be your best guess on when Poland, Czech, Hungary, Romania joined the Eurozone?
So Bulgaria would definitely like to join. I mean, they've already applied, and unfortunately, the country was not allowed to join along with Croatia. So I guess that when inflation will be reduced, then Bulgaria would be the first country to join. Not least because before joining the euro, 2 years have to be passed in the so-called exchange rate mechanism of the EU, which means that a country has to enter this exchange rate mechanism and have to spend 2 years in that. And Bulgaria is already over those 2 years. So for Bulgaria, already the numerical criteria, and also there is also a criterion on the central bank law, which has to be met. But then Bulgaria entry will be automatic. But for other countries who would start to join, then again, they have to apply. The application has to be accepted and approved. And unfortunately, there is no clear criteria whether such an application is approved. So once a country is in the exchange rate mechanism, then the process is in a sense unstoppable, because if they meet the criteria, then automatically it gets in. But there is no formal criteria for joining the exchange rate mechanism. That's a discretionary decision. So if the current members don't want a country to join, then they simply not allow that country to enter. But coming back to the prediction, so my expectation is that Bulgaria would be the first country to join. Perhaps Bulgaria the second.
Romania.
Romania. So Bulgaria the first, Romania the second. And I think the game changer would be Poland. Now, Poland is a new government. I admit I haven't heard about their intention of whether it has changed compared to the euro. But if Poland would join, that would put a very strong pressure on the Czech Republic and Hungary, because then these two countries would be remaining out from Central and Eastern Europe. So that might even change the views of the Hungarian government if Poland would decide to join. But as you indicate, this is not yet discussed, not yet on the card. So I'm afraid there is little chance that during this decade this would happen.
Yes, I have to concur that in this parliament's term, any move towards euro is probably out of the question. There are other priorities around the rule of law and getting the EU funds on board and energy transition. So I think the euro is not a top priority in this cycle. And also, as you rightly pointed out, there's no widespread social consensus on that either. So that has to wait until perhaps the next political cycle. Salt, thank you very much. This was very insightful. I enjoyed our conversation a lot, and I hope this clarifies this issue for our listeners.
Thank you, Adam, very much for inviting me.